We're currently experiencing technical difficulties with our Milwaukee feed. Please stand by and enjoy this music.
Explain this tax cut for the wealthy, which has been debated and debated and debated for months now. Why would he put this off the table? What's wrong with taxing those who make a great deal of money in this society a little bit more?
Well, again, this is a fundamental philosophical difference, again, between the two parties. I mean, his approach that I would agree with is actually when you take a look at that number, I'm going to give you a number that was put together actually by the Tax Policy Center, which is economic group of jointly of Brookings Institute and the Urban Institute, said that if that increase were to occur, that 894,000 small businesses across the country would have to pay more taxes, or about 2,000 per congressional district. The problem when you raise taxes on that, the group that tends to get hit is small business. And so right now, the idea is if we're going to grow this economy and create jobs, that's not who we want to be increasing taxes on. So, but the philosophical debate, obviously, the other direction is, well, who else is going to pay for it? I would suggest that a growing economy and more people working will generate more income than an increasing taxes in terms of those over 250.
Isn't there a way to get to some of those people who gave themselves huge raises on Wall Street?
I would assume so, but sort of this across the board 250,000 and up is clearly not the way to do it. Again, from my perspective.
We're going to welcome phone calls for David Winston. Here's our phone number. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We have two guests with us for All Things Political. James Fallows from The Atlantic will be joining us a little bit later. David Winston has been with us many times before. He is currently senior advisor to the Speaker of the House, John Boehner. He is president of the Winston Group, strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership, and worked very closely with Newt Gingrich in his Congress. So we'll welcome phone calls in just a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Willem from Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I guess the problem that I have with Paul Ryan's theory is it's just like a rehash of things that we've seen before. Somehow the magic of the supposed free market is going to lower health care costs for senior citizens, which is this voucher system is just a way of giving tax dollars to private insurance companies who are somehow going to make it more competitive and make health care more affordable for senior citizens. I just don't see any. It's not logical. There's no evidence of that. Right now we have a private health care system with multiple numbers of insurance companies. There are so many different hospitals that compete with each other, little clinics, and somehow the price of health care keeps going up and up. And I've heard this blamed on the fact that Medicare is the reason that health care is going up. It's like this Reaganomics idea, supply-side economics. Somehow we give the wealthy people and corporations all these tax benefits, and somehow they're going to create wealth when the fact is all they've done is used their increased wealth to invest in foreign labor. Now they're moving to Vietnam that has the cheapest labor. And somehow this is supposed to benefit the average working people of America. I just don't see any evidence for that. It's trickling down. I see it trickling up. In fact, I see it pouring up.
All right, let's get a response. David?
Well, there are two pieces there. Let me start off with the Medicare side. First off, one of the elements in terms of Medicare Part D with a more private sector focused approach ended up costing a lot less than people thought it would. Ultimately, Medicare, like I said, is insolvent at this point. And one of the reasons you see costs going up on a consistent basis is because, in fact, you don't have that competition. If you're somebody in Wisconsin, you can't buy an insurance package from a company in Iowa. It's got to be something provided specifically in Wisconsin. And so that lack of competition certainly creates problems. I want to go back to the whole idea, at least in terms of what tax cuts do. And if I may use this example, in 2003, when the Bush tax cuts were passed, the revenue to the United States was $1.9 trillion. When Bush left, it went up to $2.7 trillion. That was an increase of $800 billion. As a result of those tax cuts, the reason is because it generated economic activity. What generates revenues is economic activity, not tax, and the level of taxation sort of sets that level of economic activity. That was the fundamental premise behind at least supply side, which is certainly where Paul Ryan is sort of focused as well.
But we have this huge unemployment rate right now, too, so we need some economic activity on the part of all those people who don't have jobs. How does this budget plan address that, or how does anybody address that? Is anybody addressing that?
No, well, that's where you get to, and again, this does go back to the sort of supply side, the idea that by cutting taxes, you allow businesses to invest, and that's going to create jobs. That's certainly what happened when you go back to the last big level of unemployment, which was back in the early 80s. You had the 81 tax cuts, and ultimately by 84 you saw a really growing economy with low unemployment. The idea here is again similar. by making sure that small businesses can grow as opposed to taxing them and taking dollars away, that's the way to sort of get things moving. Again, the idea here is Republican, you know, this is sort of, you know, I will grant you sort of trite in the way it comes out, but you'll see the differences between the two parties. You know, Democrats want to create more taxes and Republicans want to create more taxpayers. And that's sort of a trite way, but nonetheless a clear way in terms of defining potentially the two differences, the two sides of the debate.
Louis is next in Wausau. Hi, Louis.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like to point out something that I think is very important, but you don't hear much about, and that is that most new jobs are not created by people who are making money, but by companies that are less than 5 years old, startup companies who aren't making money, aren't paying taxes. And another thing that is interesting to me is that most rich people, more than half, are rich through inheritance, and the next leading cause is divorce, and then you can go on and on. So the rich are not creating jobs. They are mostly idle. And that's my comment.
All right. Thanks for the call. David?
Well, I would disagree. Having started up a small company, I mean, but part of the dynamic is, yes, in the first year or two, things tend to be a little difficult. And if I had known that, I might have taken a different course. but ultimately, I mean, you need some startup capital, right? And so that's investment capital. Somebody's got to be willing to give you that. The risk in terms of starting up a company is pretty significant, and so the incentive in terms of will it succeed, given high tax rates, where you somebody in terms of who's investing that money, if they think that there's a likelihood that they won't get much return, then they'd be better off buying commodities, and that's why you've seen oil, gold, a variety of different things increase in value, because people are purchasing commodities rather than investing in businesses and hopefully new jobs. And so that's the whole theory in terms of keeping rates low enough so that people who make those investments can actually get a return on them.
Thanks, Louis, for the call. Let's go to Barbara in South Milwaukee. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I'd just like to comment with due respect to the guest and to Paul Ryan. You know, I teach in this area, and I'm sorry, reiterating ideology just doesn't work here. I'm old enough to remember when Ronald Reagan started the trickle-down thing, and deregulation has just amounted to the money going up to the top 1%, and we haven't seen any change in that. Yes, we see economic activity, but it's economic activity at that top 1%, and my guess has always been that the goal of all of this is to, you know, allow that top 1% to take the jobs out of the country, to bankrupt our middle class, to bankrupt this country, and then they'll come back with the jobs here and people will work for anything as they currently do in much of the third world. I'm with all due respect, I just can't see. The ideology hasn't worked for the majority of Americans, and I can't see more of that working for the majority of Americans.
All right, Barbara, thank you. David?
Well, the idea that the wealthy in the country are specifically have a plan that they want to bankrupt the middle class, I mean, I would suggest that's a little beyond the pale. But having said that, look, I mean, the quality of life in this country, certainly in the 80s and 90s and stretching into the early 2000s, was certainly quite good. Having said that, right now we are in a very difficult situation, and part of what we're facing is, to a large degree, we've spent at a level that we shouldn't be. That we can't afford, and so we're looking forward into the future in terms of making some very tough choices at this point. And they are going to be difficult, and the question is, how do we best get this economy going to try to generate more revenues to be able to cover some of that? But also, we're just going to have to deal with some facts that we're going to have to live within our means, and that's not necessarily a easy dynamic to resolve.
Thank you, Barbara. Bill in Prairie du Sac. Hi, Bill.
Yes, I have two questions. One, I do not understand how you continually make the connection between taxing the rich and small businesses. There's no correlation between the two things. You just simply deflect every question about taxes to small businesses.
If I may, if you're a specific type of small business, your income is treated as personal income. So if your business does $1 million a year, It looks like you're making $1 million a year when, in fact, it's your small business. So you would be treated the same as someone who is actually getting a salary of that. And so you, as small business is treated as though it's personal income.
Mm-hmm.
Be written to.
I'm sorry, Bill, we missed the first part. What, Bill?
It would be very easy to write a tax bill that would change that. That is not insurmountable. And my other question would quickly be, that Medicare, if you measure administrative cost percentages and then percentages that actually of the funds that actually supply health care, Medicare is by far the most efficient of all the health care providers we have in this country.
You agree with that, David?
Well, the problem that exists with Medicare, and this is what is constantly referred to as the doc fix, is that Medicare underpays doctors, and a lot of doctors, are opting out of participating in Medicare because they can't afford to the level of which they're being paid. And what that's also doing as a result is you're seeing a lot of doctors, what they will do is they will accept those payments but then charge private insurance holders more to sort of recoup the losses they had in terms of Medicare. To get Medicare up to the level in terms of paying doctors close to what they would be willing to accept, which is, again, what this doc fix is on a consistent basis, is part of the problem that we're facing as we go forward. It is not an efficient system until we figure out how, in fact, to make sure that doctors will stay in the system. And I think what you've seen from a lot of people is they've begun to hear from their doctors that they may not be accepting Medicare anymore, or they may actually be dropping Medicare patients.
You know, maybe I'm making this up, or it was in a dream or something I had, which is entirely possible. but didn't the president say something about this when we had this huge debate about health care reform in this country and that it was part of the fix? Or is that not true?
No, that was something that was a separate bill that was going to happen on its own, and that was part of the debate and discussion. But he didn't specifically address that in the health care bill. His intention, which did occur, it was addressed outside. But that's one of the reasons why Republicans have said that the actual cost of the health care bill is not reflected in its total because it didn't include what is commonly known as the doc fix.
All right, but the bill did include. I'm still confused.
No, the bill did not include.
It did
that.
Not include the doc fix. No. You know, when we get back to this, though, we've been debating this issue for years in this country. It still goes back to the cost of health care. We haven't figured out why it keeps going up so significantly and how really to curb those expenses. Have
no,
we?
No, we have. I mean, there are things that you can point to, and you know, you've got a variety of different things. I don't necessarily I could talk about tort reform or a variety of different things, but part of it is that also we have two things happening. One, right now we have an aging population, and obviously as you get older, you consume more healthcare, and you've got the baby boomers approaching or in retirement at this point. And then the other element, which is good, the quality of health care here is such that you're seeing, as those people get older, the chances they have in terms of living longer and having healthier lives, the health care system can deliver that. But the problem you have is, of course, that's very expensive. And so we as a society have got to figure out how do we deal with this. And again, these are not simple problems to resolve, and as a result, the cost of health care is going up.
David, thank you so much for being with us. Always a pleasure to have you on the air.
Thanks for having
Thanks.
Me.
David Winston, who is now senior advisor to Speaker of the House, John Boehner, and he has worked with a number of very prominent Republican senior advisor and is with Winston Group, in which he advises mostly Republicans and also people all over the world on politics. We continue our All Things Political, changing guests now, which means changing viewpoints. James Fallows is joining us the last half hour of this hour, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He is a 25-year veteran of the magazine and a former speechwriter for Jimmy Carter. He's also a pilot, and he is a Washington national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has lived in Seattle, Berkeley, Austin, Tokyo, Kuala Lumpur, Shanghai, and Beijing. and he is chair in U.S. media at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney in Australia. He writes a really interesting blog, which I've just discovered. I hear him on the radio frequently and read him in The Atlantic, but his blog is pretty inspiring and covers all kinds of issues from hacking emails to Bob Dylan's concert in China and whether or not it was pointed enough politically. Greg Mortensen's Three Cups of Tea, which we'll ask him to talk about because it was on 60 Minutes, and we've had Greg on the air a couple times. And, of course, he talks a great deal about how to reduce the deficit and the different visions we have of government. So your phone calls are still A-OK, and the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, James.
Very nice, Kathleen. Very nice to talk to you. I'm glad you're on the air.
Thank you very much, James. I'm glad you're on the air. So here we are. We're rolling.
Here we are.
What's the story with Ayn Rand? I mean, I remember reading Ayn Rand when I was in college, and it was kind of a lark, and we talked about it a little bit. Why is Ayn Rand front and center in required reading, at least among Republicans in Washington?
You know, it is a question I've thought about. When I was ahead of you, when I was 14 and 15, that was my big Ayn Rand stage in Southern California. Which was a hotbed of that kind of thinking. And I had always thought it was something that for adolescent boys in particular what was appealing because of the purity of the vision. Let not these little people trouble me. Let me, in my purity, do what I should. And I'm not meaning to entirely mock the what she also often calls objectivist or libertarian view, but it had seemed to me emotionally the best match to sort of young men. I recognize that it's being that it's in many ways the guiding spirit of some of the Tea Party movement, and we can get into all how much this actually matches the course of American history. Whether Ayn Rand herself turned down government medical and pension benefits in her later years, which is an interesting story. Short answer is she did not. That's my brief Ayn Rand view.
So who's your guiding spirit? Did Jimmy Carter tell you that you ought to read this book or that book as you were his speechwriter?
If I had to choose a founding father or mother to sit and talk with, it would probably be Alexander Hamilton.
Really?
He was somebody who I thought had the view that stands up best in the long run of what it takes to make a strong country. And sure, there's a lot of other people in those days would be interesting, too, from, Franklin, Jefferson, and Washington. We could go down this road. But I have a soft spot for Alexander Hamilton and a great biography of him by Ron Chernow a few years ago.
Oh, okay. Thank you. All right.
You're welcome.
We wrote that down. All right, let's talk about the budget here. Your father was a doctor. I was reading your blogs. They're terrific. I love your blogs.
Oh, thank you.
And you wrote in a recent one that we need to start thinking about what it would mean to go back to the pre-Medicare era in which each family had to prepare for unknowably large late-in-life expenses. And tell it through the eyes of your father, who thought it was socialism initially. I'm wondering if he changed his mind and what we need to think about when we think about pre-Medicare.
Well, this was during the same time when I was an Ayn Randian back in the mid-1960s when the Medicare debate was going on. This was in a small town in Southern California, and my dad was the local small-town doctor. And in those days, his very strong view and that of the American Medical Association was that you couldn't really have that if the government were involved in any way in this physician-patient relationship, that would mean socialized medicine and sort of the end of that part of American independence. We all know the things that are wrong with large organized medicine now, whether publicly organized or by the health insurance companies. But the step that I thought we had irreversibly taken now 45 years ago was the idea that it was just bad for everybody if older people, who of course by definition are going to be sicker than everybody else, they're that much closer to the end of their lives, and actuarially, especially then, were poorer than other people, if they all had the risk of this, of not knowing whether it would be $100,000 they might have for some medical procedure or $1 million or whatever, and the distortion imposed on everybody by that unlimited risk. which is what, and so therefore the universal coverage that came with Medicare was in a way the mirror image of, say, a universal right to school or immunizations or things like that. When children are little, we don't make six-year-olds pay their own taxes for public school, and so too, given that people at the end of their lives are going to be more reliant on medical care, it was a way of buffering that very, very distorting uncertainty that came in. So I thought that issue had been settled, but apparently not.
How do we make that care, which is very expensive and where most of our money goes for health care in our lifetimes, less expensive? Is there a way to bring down the cost?
Certainly there has to be, and this is has been for 30 or 40 years now a central focus of any issue, any debate about health policy. As I'm sure we all heard a year and a half ago during the health plan debates, the United States spends much more than any other nation on the health care system, with outcomes that on average are not better than other countries. At the top end, we have more elaborate procedures, but on average, our medical care is not better than other countries that spend like half as much. And so most people think that the way to do this is not so much individual sort of consumer rights. That is, if you're shopping for a car or a house, you're able to comparison shop and all that. When you're going to the emergency room, when the doctor says you need this drug, X, Y, and Z, it's not really the same kind of informed consumer choice where you can try lots of different options. So it seems to be structural changes, and I'm actually, later today I'll have a very interesting post I got from somebody on this point. But it's a large issue that needs to be, in my view, sort of structural changes rather than just having you be a more careful shopper for MRIs.
Mm-hmm. And tell people how they can get your posts, because I highly recommend them. They're really, well done.
The magazine I've worked for lo these many years is The Atlantic, and so it's just theatlantic.com. And my little corner of it is my name, jamesfallows.theatlantic.com.
Okay. Yeah, it's very good. Let's talk about taxes for a moment. Paul Ryan proposing, and we've had discussions about sort of putting a flat tax, which would lower everybody's tax rates, including the very wealthy. And this has been a big philosophical difference and the topic of much discussion. David Winston, our guest before you, said that if we were to cut taxes to increase taxes on the wealthy among us, it would affect 894,000 small businesses who would have to pay more taxes, which would devastate the economy.
I am not prepared to engage on that figure or that level of detail. I will say that for a long time now, probably even since the Reagan years, there's been an effort to make more of the entire income base taxable and therefore to lower the overall rate that applies to it. And this has had very imperfect success. For example, many people would agree to that in principle, but then as soon as you say that means your mortgage interest is not deductible, your charitable contributions are not deductible, your state income tax is not deductible, often people look at it in a different way. And business income, corporate income, has been a much smaller part of the tax base over the last 30 years than it was before. So I think everybody agrees in principle it would be better to sort of less distorting to spread the tax burden more broadly, but it has been difficult to do that because almost any specific thing you want to bring under the umbrella, there's resistance to.
James Fell is our guest. We have a ton of phone calls for you, and we're going to hop right to them. Jeff in Milwaukee is first. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi.
I think the focus should be more on wealthy individuals as far as any increase in tax. Probably should be the increase should probably start with those earning around $1 million or $2 million every year. Every year. It's not like they make it, here, there, and everywhere. But I would think that most truly small businesses shouldn't have a tax increase at all. That's what I think, anyway.
And I think that I agree with the main spirit of what you're saying. And I think here is a way to think of it, which is really shocking when you reflect on it. And now I think it's either over the last 25 or 30 years, the median household income in the United States has not gone up. The United States is much richer as an entity than it was 30 years ago, but most people are not, by the normal economic measures, their income has not gone up in that time, with inflation is factored in. And so an overwhelming proportion of the gains in national wealth in the last 30 years have gone to the top 5% and really the top 1% of the income and wealth distribution. And whatever are the mechanics producing that, it does suggest that having a higher tax burden on the part of the population that has received the overwhelming share of the gain of wealth in the last 20 years makes sense.
Yeah. You know, as Bernie Sanders keeps asking, and I think it's a valid question, considering the fact that we have so many problems and so many people out of work and we're trying to cover health care, is you've got to ask the philosophical question of how much is enough. If you're making an incredible amount of money, I don't know, James, how you can spend it. I just don't. I don't want to be too simple about this, but it seems to me as though to help other people out who aren't making billions, that you ought to give some of it to people so they can have health care.
Here are, yes, well, here are two sort of opposing observations I'd have on that, and then I'll net them out. One thing I've observed is that almost no matter how much money people have made, I have by chance, I have a few friends who are very, very wealthy.
Do
in,
you?
In the billionaire category. Nobody ever really thinks they have enough. They always think that if you had maybe about 50% more than you have now, that would be enough. And on the other hand, compared with 20 years ago, compared with 40 years ago, it's true both that the people at the top have more and they are taxed relatively less. So if you went back even to the dark ages of the first George Bush era or the Clinton era, when the economy, especially in the Clinton era, was doing well, the burden at the top was much higher than it is now. So we could go back only 20 years and restore that, and we'd have be much closer to sort of reducing the debt and deficit then. Mm.
So these billionaire friends of yours, or at least the one you might have, when
I
you
have several, believe it or not,
you have several. Wow, I don't know any.
One of them is a terrible person. The other, okay.
A terrible person couldn't be a friend of yours.
You know, I guess I could say there are four people I know pretty well who are in the billionaire category. One of them is horrible. The other three are admirable. And there's different industrial bases that have been the root of their wealth, and I won't get any more detailed than that.
Well, when you go out to dinner, do they pick up the bill or not?
The one who's horrible does not. The other, with the others, is kind of awkward because, you know, the scale of money is so much different. What $1,000 to them is like half a dollar to me in terms of their sort of relative income. But
yeah.
I won't go down this road much further.
Much as I want to take you there, you won't. All right, let's pause for just a moment. James Fallows is our guest, and it's all things political is what's happening this hour of the program. Our number is 800-486-8655. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. I highly recommend you go to his blog. It is really, really thoughtful on a variety of issues. He's a former speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. He's a pilot. He spent a lot of time, and I understand he also has a book in progress about China. He wrote some fascinating blogs about Bob Dylan in China, and he is finishing another book. We'll ask him what that's about as we reach the end of this hour. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Angela from Fitchburg. Hi.
Hello. I'd just like to speak to the healthcare cost containment recommendations. And I know that you had a guest or caller who said that recommendations, just people don't have ideas about how to do this. Well, Donna Shalala actually made a report with the Institute on Medicine, and her first recommendation for cost containment and quality of care in America is that we need to use nurses and nurse practitioners to the full level of their
yes,
training.
I remember that. We talked to her about that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to point out that nurse practitioners are able to provide high-quality care at a great value, but state regulations are inconsistent across the country, and insurance reimbursement policies also really prevent nurse practitioners from being able to practice independently. And if we could allow them to do that, that would be a wonderful way to contain costs and still prevent great preventive care. I think the model would really help to promote health instead of our current top-heavy system where we are spending so much on people whose prevention never happened, and then they become incredibly ill and very expensive to care for.
James.
Yes. Number one, I agree with that entirely. Number two, I also agree that there is a gigantic body of information and ideas out there about various ways to to limit the growth in medical spending. And number three, a sort of parallel point to the nurse practitioner one, is have been the regulations until fairly recently against home-based care or hospice service or things like that, which can be provide a much less expensive alternative to very high-tech institutionalized medicine. So I agree with the caller.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. You have said in a recent blog, looking more at this serious Mr. Ryan, a plan to deal with budget problems that says virtually nothing about military spending is neither brave nor serious. It would be enough to disqualify it from the serious bracket. Why don't we look at military budgets? I was seeing the amount of money that it costs to have all these bases all over the world. Do we really need those now?
One benchmark is the United States, as people have grown sort of inured to thinking about, spends more money on the military than the rest of the world combined. Which, and I think over the last 10 years, we've gotten used to the idea that we're not going to have to pay for any of this because taxes don't go up to pay for military spending or military commitments. So I think that it is a subject people don't feel compelled to address because the taxes and the absence of a draft don't link it back to our general, daily life. And it's complicated to address and all that. So I think that if we're going to make sense of our both public spending and public revenues, the military budget has to be part of that.
Yeah. I'd like to hear your thoughts on a couple things. One, I know you wrote yesterday about the devastating takedowns of Greg Mortensen's Three Cups of Tea. He has relatives in the state of Wisconsin. He's been a very big deal in this state. It was a fairly devastating news report, but you couple that with a truly inspirational report. And then I also want you to comment on our continuing efforts in Afghanistan and what the end game is there.
On Greg Mortensen, I don't know anything about him especially. I'm just a layman. I've enjoyed his books and admired his cause. And it's possible that the 1-2 punch of the LA Times and 60 Minutes is off in some way, but at face value, this was quite distressing, both about his own personal tale and also about the financial operations of the charity. So I hope there is some kind of benign explanation for this, because one doesn't want to have inspiring stories taken away. And I mentioned
exactly.
On my site, this very a very uplifting, different kind of story of a man who's now in his early 30s who was a combat Marine in Iraq and the Horn of Afghanistan and simultaneously was running this kind of urban uplift program in Nairobi, Kenya. And how he managed to pull off that combination is told in his book, which is called It Happened on the Way to War.
Okay, we'll have that
so
person
on Afghanistan. My view all along has been that when the U.S. first went in there, now almost 10 years ago, that was the right thing to do. But a long-term effort to pacify or re-govern Afghanistan seems to me extremely unlikely and extremely dicey, and you can have gains week by week, but year by year it's very difficult to see how the U.S. can accomplish what in theory it's supposed to do. So my own view over the last couple of years is we need to find the most expeditious way to curtail our involvement there, because it seems to me an unwinnable investment.
Mm-hmm. Angela, thanks for your call some time ago. Al in Land O'Lakes, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
All right, Al, how are you?
Pretty good.
Good.
I really appreciate what you guys do, because it gives guys like me a chance to vent their frustrations a little bit. Anyway, I just reread Rich Dad, Poor Dad. This is back to taxes and trickle-down economics. This was from 97. Robert Kiyosaki wrote it. And one of the quotes on here is from J.P. Morgan Chase. Rich Dad, Poor Dad is a must-read for millionaires. He's got a simple diagram here. It's a cross. And on one side, it's employees and salesmen. On the other side, it's bankers and investors. The banker and investor sides don't pay taxes, I saw a couple of news shows yesterday. One of them was, we pass a new law into the tax code, which is, by the way, more extensive than the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. We pass a new law every day. It's an unlevel playing field. And, I recently became a poor person, but there's a lot of us out here, and we're all just getting screwed. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call, Al.
Yes, I would say that the complexity and inequality of our tax code has been an issue through perpetuity. Again, I mentioned earlier my admiration for Alexander Hamilton. He was corresponding early on with the other founding fathers about the whole business of taxes. It's always been complex because money is it's a matter of moving money. What's different, I think, in the last 20 years is that more of the benefits and shoulders have gone to the very top, and this is not just some kind of opinion of mine. It's what all the economic data show, and also there has become worrisomely less mobility in America. In America, the trade-off for inequality has always been the American dream, the idea that you can change your family prospects, and certainly that is still more true here than in many other parts of the world, but it is less true in general than it used to be, and that is worrisome.
Yeah. Could we talk a little bit about job creation? It wasn't all that long ago that the president was getting pounded for not making that a real priority of his. We've kind of lost all that conversation. Unemployment rate is still quite high in this country. There are a lot of people who need good middle-class jobs.
Yes, and I think there is a short-term and a long-term issue. The short-term issue, this is the other side of the deficit concern slash hysteria that many people have, because the established way, if you cut government spending in the short term as a certainty, that's going to eliminate jobs. You know, there are some tens of thousands of jobs that just because of this the budget agreement passed last week will be eliminated. So in the short term, you want more government spending rather than less as a sort of job alleviation business. In the longer term, having middle class jobs, that's part of the larger industrial structure of the United States. And that is, you know, a whole other two-hour argument.
Right.
But I think that's investment in schools and technology, mm-hmm, and the right kind of trade policy and all of that.
Yeah. We have about 45 seconds for this call. Hi, John.
Hi, quick one. I was going to suggest that right now there's about 4 billion shares traded a day on the New York Stock Exchange, 2 billion on the NASDAQ. If you put a penny per share tax on that, you would generate about 40 to 60 million a day, about $300 million a week, and that could generate probably $10 to $15 billion a year.
All right, I like it. James?
Yes, and there actually are many very prominent economists, as you may well be yourself too, who agree exactly with that, that it would discourage, in addition to raising revenue, it would discourage pure speculation, because our financial sector and speculation are too large a share of our economy relative to other things.
Yeah, good idea. Keep bringing it up, John. Bob Dylan in China was great.
Thank you. So I'll tell you, Bob Dylan, China was great. If you're talking about my writing about it, well,
yes.
Thank you for that.
It's great. I really liked it. Thanks, James. It's always a great treat
to
talk with you, and we'll continue following your marvelous blogs, too. I can't believe I'm just discovering them. I've read his books, but he's an interesting guy, as is David Winston. It was a really good hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and to Rhonda Fanning as well. It was really a good hour. I like this hour. Different points of view, great guests, good calls. Doesn't get much better. What else did I want to say? So thank you. I wanted to say thank you. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Monday conversation. We'll talk about space and entertain your phone calls in just a little while. This is the Ideas Network.